Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any absolute appeal to authority. We are joined today by the scientist Dr. Emma Byrne. Emma normally specialises in the field of artificial intelligence. However, she's recently taken a different tack and is here to talk about her latest book entitled Swearing is Good for You. Using peer-reviewed science, she argues that swearing is likely to have been one of the first forms of language that we developed, and that since then it's been helping us to deal with pain, work together, manage our emotions and improve our minds.
Okay, well, hello Emma. Welcome to the Middle Way Society podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, well, to begin with, Emma, could you perhaps tell us a bit about your background, what prompted you to write the book, and perhaps what assumptions about swearing you were interested in challenging?
Yeah, sure. So my background is actually in artificial intelligence, and I spent some of my early postdoctoral years working on a project that was using robots to try to understand the genome of yeast. So we were doing experiments with automated lab equipment that I was, you know, doing some smart stuff for. The problem was that in that lab, if you're feeding yeast, you tend to feed it on other mashed up dead yeast. So the whole lab stank of Marmite. And no offence to the fine people who are in the love it camp, but I'm definitely in the hate it camp. So I ended up leaving there and working in a lab that worked on computational neuroscience, which is basically modelling how the human brain might work using computers to try to understand it better, test a few hypotheses. And there was no actual touching of brains required, so it's considerably less yucky than the genetics experiments. And while I was there, I started reading the neuroscience papers that people had in the lab. It was then that I found this by now quite famous study about putting your hand in ice water and how much longer you can endure that if you're swearing. And I was looking for papers that had experiments in that I could basically run on some members of the public. But I started reading the citations in that paper that were all about swearing, and then the citations in those papers, and then the citations in the papers after that. And it just grew exponentially. And after a while, I thought there's absolutely got to be a book in this because there's so much fascinating stuff that's been done about science. But unlike research into, you know, what cures cancer or what might get us to the furthest planets in the solar system, the swearing stuff wasn't really making it into the mainstream media. So, yeah, I really wanted to share all of this amazing science with people.
Brilliant. Okay, well, in the book, you argue that, among other things, swearing helps us to manage pain, alleviate aggression, bond with others, work more efficiently, that it's associated with intelligence, honesty and trust. Now, we can touch on all these ideas a little bit during our chat, but to begin with, what is swearing and why is it so pervasive?
Well, the thing is, there's no standardised definition anywhere for swearing. So that was one of the first challenges, is trying to compare all of these studies when they all had slightly different definitions.
Yeah.
But what we tend to find that swearing has in common is that it touches on subjects that are taboo in that particular society. So it's very societally laden, and it also varies through time within a single society. And we know that it tends to invoke really strong emotions in both the speaker and the listener. So putting together those two features tends to allow you to kind of identify in any language, you know, what's taboo, what's highly emotional. That's usually what's regarded as the corpus of swearing for that language.
Okay. What's the relationship, would you say, between swearing and violence?
So we tend to think of people who swear more as being potentially more threatening or more violent, but actually the research doesn't bear that out. Swearing can be used to offset emotion, particularly the kind of strong emotion that might lead to violence. And we know, particularly in studies of toddlers, that as soon as they start using their taboo words as a form of insult, so my niece has just started using the words poo face when she's cross, but that replaces physical violence in those children. We know that preventing people from swearing is more likely to lead to, you know, physical violence or mistakes in driving or in other high stress scenarios. So swearing can actually reduce the amount of either physical violence or self-harm that people end up doing because it provides a safe outlet.
Okay, but it's not connected with the idea of catharsis, which in psychology now has suggested that often anger can actually beget anger. So if you, for example, if you had a punch bag down in your cellar with your boss's face on it, by punching that picture, the chances are you're going to get more angry about your boss. But this is more about, as you say, an outlet, yeah? The two things are different.
That's right. And although we know that swearing tends to do things like increase adrenaline and heart rate, that when we swear, we're sending a very strong social signal of either distress or anger or frustration. And quite often that's what we would be using violence to do instead. So it's a substitute for that violent act.
Is there any statistics to say how many people do swear? On average, how many do we all swear in certain situations?
Now, there are several people who will claim that they never swear, but the only ones that science has shown absolutely do not swear are the ones who've had severe brain damage on the right-hand side of the brain that affects the emotional sort of centres of the brain. And so patients who've had a stroke on the right side of the brain quite often have problems with emotional processing. And that leads to some really strange deficits. So, for example, they have no understanding of jokes anymore. So if you provide them with the setup for a joke and then four alternative versions of a punchline, three of which are just not funny, and the fourth of which is at least arguably amusing, they do know better than random chance. But also, if you try to prompt them into using swearing phrases or ask them where a swear word might be appropriate, they just don't do it. They become completely immune to the emotional effect of swearing. So the only people that we know for sure scientifically don't swear are those that have got this emotional processing deficit after a stroke.
Oh, that's really interesting. That reminds me of a book by Brain Lateralization by Ian McGilchrist, and he talks about if people's right hemisphere has been knocked out by either lesion or stroke, he sort of says that the right hemisphere in some ways is the bullshit detector or the big picture thing. So for example, if you say all monkeys climb trees, a porcupine is a monkey, therefore porcupines climb trees. If you've got your right hemisphere intact, then you just think, oh well, that's nonsense. But because the structure of the argument makes sense, then someone who's only working with a left hemisphere will think that makes sense too. And that sort of ties in a similar way with what you're saying about humour as well and swearing.
Yeah, and it's a really interesting point that you make about whether or not there is this sort of bullshit detector required to basically just cope with life, particularly the way that... that at the moment there are stories that ostensibly come from reliable sources, but actually are fed to us through our social media accounts and so on, that we can quite often be overwhelmed by stuff that is bullshit. And if we don't allow ourselves to use this kind of bullshit detector, the sniff test, is it consistent with what we understand, this sort of rapid processing, it's very easy to be drawn into things that absolutely aren't true. So that quick and dirty processing that basically says, does this fit with what I think really is going on in the world? Then if, you know, it is very easy to be misled. But one of the problems is that we also have, based on the same equipment, basically, is a thing called confirmation bias, yeah, which means we can sometimes be very quick to accept things as long as they are consistent with things that we want to believe. Yeah. So the bullshit detector is really useful as long as we're not being told something that it actually pleases us to believe is true. So how we train ourselves out of that is a really tricky question, but I think it's one we're going to have to really come to terms with, yeah, as we get more and more echo chambery in our social media feeds.
Yeah, fascinating. Okay, well, you've touched on the idea of pain where you talked about this the hand in the icy water test. So could you perhaps unpack that a little bit more? What's going on with swearing and pain and how it can be helpful?
Sure. So we know certain things about how swearing works to dull pain. For example, we know that there is a dose effect. If you use swear words that are less powerful, then it certainly seems from preliminary studies that they provide much less relief than if you're using a stronger one. So the person who has this research group up at Keele University, Dr. Richard Stevens, says he quite enjoys talking about this experiment because it means he gets to say bum a lot. But if you're saying things like bum or sugar, you just don't get the same amount of pain relief, which means that it's got to be something to do with not just the sound of the word and not just the fact that we know it relates to a particularly sort of taboo semantic item in our lexicon. It's actually something about those words in particular. We also know, for example, that people who get themselves into a higher state of aggression can withstand pain for longer. So one of his students did a terrific experiment where she had people play either a golfing simulator or a first-person shooter, and then ran various tests to see how aggressive playing those games had got them, and found that, yes, consistently, the first-person shooter made people primed to be more aggressive than the golfing game, which surprised me because I find golf very frustrating, but there you go. And those people who played the first-person shooter were much more able to withstand the pain than those who played the golfing game. So it may well be something to do with aggression. The thing is, we're not quite sure, because when you are trying to induce an emotion in a laboratory setting, there is a problem that you can never really induce pure emotion as a sort of single clear tone. Mm-hmm. And the best example of that is there's a brilliant study that I'd sort of reference in passing in the book because it wasn't enough to do with swearing, but it was really interesting, which is a pain study where they tried to induce a feeling of fear beforehand to see if fear affected pain. Mm-hmm. And they found that it was disconfirming the rest of the literature, which said that if you're fearful, pain feels worse. They said, this is really strange. We're trying to make people feel fearful, but they're saying that the pain feels less when we induce this emotional state. It's only about five papers down the line after they've tried various different types of doing this experiment, they went, oh yeah, it's just occurred to us that if you take people into a lab setting and tell them that you're going to make them feel afraid by doing all these things to them, they also end up feeling quite angry as well. So maybe it was the anger that was making them feel less pain. So this is the problem. It's really, really tricky to devise experimental setups that are just sophisticated enough to isolate some form of behavior, some form of emotion. So far we haven't quite been able to pinpoint what it is other than an increase in some emotional state, and that possibly aggression is something to do with it.
Okay, but if swearing, and it seems to be the case, is an analgesic, are there any signs that the medical profession is starting to employ it, recommend it?
I wouldn't say they're going all out and recommending it, but certainly there have been some papers recently that have tried to unpick the sort of the pros and cons of allowing patients to swear and of training medical professionals to understand the difference between somebody being aggressive towards them and the quite correct sort of response on the part of that medical professional of wanting to put a distance between themselves and the person being aggressive, but also recognizing that there are times when patients will swear for entirely different reasons. And those could be organic, like, for example, Tourette's syndrome or dementia, and even some forms of Parkinson's disease can lead to this kind of linguistic tick that can sometimes involve swearing, or it might be psychological and to do with enormous amounts of stress. And somehow striking a balance that's a little bit more compassionate than just saying, once this person swears, I'm going to remove myself from this caring situation. But that said, I mean, it's really important to recognize that healthcare professionals that are dealing with aggression, whether it comes in the form of swearing or not, require a great deal of support because they have such stressful jobs and stressful encounters doing this sort of caring labour, and they are increasingly overloaded. So I'm by no means sort of saying to any nurses or doctors or physiotherapists out there, yeah, let your patients swear at you with impunity. Their well-being counts as well.
Yeah, that's a very good point, actually. You touched there on Tourette's syndrome, and I found your chapter on that condition extremely moving, actually, and challenged some assumptions that I had about the condition. So could you clear up perhaps a few of the misconceptions that are commonplace about Tourette's?
Yeah, so first and foremost, not all Tourette syndrome sufferers actually have the desire to swear or to make obscene gestures. So those are two symptoms called coprolalia and coprographia, and somehow saying shit tongue and shit gesture in Latin makes them sound much nicer. That's only about 25% of sufferers, depending on how you count it, who suffer from that particular form of tic. But the way that Tourette syndrome sufferers end up having, you know, the greatest difficulty is not necessarily with the tics themselves, although some of the physical ones can be incredibly painful. It's with the responses of the people around them. So when you look at the statistics about young people with Tourette syndrome, and it does usually kick in sort of mid-adolescence, they're much more likely to be excluded from school. They're much more likely to report that they're excluded from social activities, and that making and maintaining friendships is really hard. And so even as the symptoms wane, as they get into adulthood, as is quite often the case, kids who've had Tourette syndrome further on in their adult life still tend to have impacts on their employment prospects, on their psychological well-being. And all of that is to do with our reaction, as you know, who aren't suffering from it, our reaction to their swearing or their tics. And if we could look at our own responses and again unpack that kind of reflexive emotional distaste for swearing from what's actually going on, this neurological drive to make these particular sounds or say these particular words, we can break that link between their symptom and our emotion and be more accepting. It would have such an enormous impact on these young people's lives. And one of the things that I find saddest about Tourette syndrome is that the treatment of choice for so long has been a type of medication that, because of the way that it works, makes it really hard for them to lay down memories, makes it really hard for them to learn new things, makes it really hard for them to go out and try new experiences, because it shuts down a lot of the pathways of reward in the brain.
Yeah.
And that's absolutely the worst thing to do to an adolescent who should be at the peak of learning and trying out new things. So Tourette syndrome is really the only illness that I can think of that we medicate the sufferers in order that the rest of us should feel better. And I would like to see more acceptance of and understanding of the behaviours that come from Tourette syndrome and the penalties that these kids end up paying because of our own emotional response to their tics.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, and you challenged some other assumptions about swearing. One of them is this idea that it stems from a stunted vocabulary.
Yeah, I mean, that was a fairly recent finding. I just serendipitously timed for the book that there are some really nice studies culminating in one recently looking at people's vocabulary and people's word fluency. So there are a number of tests for checking not just vocabulary size, but also fluency, your ability to use those words effectively. And they include tests like, for example, saying, you know, in 60 seconds, name all of the animals you could think of that begin with the letter F or what have you. You find that the better people do on these standardized tests of fluency and vocabulary, the more swearing they also tend to know and produce. And the correlation between swearing and your volume and variety of swearing and your vocabulary runs counter to what we usually tell kids, you know, as a sign of a stunted vocabulary and a terrible, you know, lack of ability to express yourself properly. That's actually not true at all. You skillfully, used with variety and panache and a really good sense of the way that your listeners' brains are processing this swearing, it's one of the most powerful linguistic tools we have. And it's used really well in things like poetry, drama, and even just rhetoric and to some extent, you know, sort of in the political scene to really underpin and underscore certain points. And when that happens, swearing can actually be beguiling. We end up sort of thinking that if someone's that passionate about something, then they must really be onto something. And again, that's one of those things I'd like people to kind of question a bit, that it is a sign of quite often a glib tongue, or someone who is, you know, who understands your emotions well enough to know how to play on them. And if that's someone that you trust, one of your workmates, that's fine. But if it's a politician who's going, you know, look how real I am, might be worth wondering whether or not that was a really well rehearsed bit of spontaneous swearing right then.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Okay, well, I'm thinking back to when I was a young man. I spent 3 years in the Navy, and I used to swear in be fucking tween words. It was that, you know. But I wonder if that is I don't know if you've heard of a linguistic term called accommodation, where, for example, when you're exposed to people with different dialects, in order to sort of socialize better or relate better, then you capture the lilt or the vocabulary at times of the other person you're speaking. So I wonder if that played a part in the fact that I swore so much because everyone else was swearing all the time.
Yeah, almost definitely. And I've noticed as well in talking to you that I grew up in Yorkshire and more of my northern's coming out. My husband is extremely pleased that I've now lived down south with him long enough that I do occasionally say bastard instead of bastard. He feels like he's won this culture war and it drives me up the wall. But yes, accommodation, definitely. There's some really nice studies from mainly Australia and New Zealand about swearing in the workplace. And that in particular on factory floors and in IT companies, which are the two main case studies, when people do use a certain swearing register, it tends to spread among the team. And that if a newcomer arrives and finds that swearing register or that jocular abuse to be, you know, something that they can't really put up with, it takes them much longer to cement their place as part of the team or to create that trust bond. Because by not doing accommodation, by not taking on the speech patterns of the people that you're working with, you show yourself as being an outsider, as wanting to remain apart from the people that you're working with. And it, on a very subconscious level, kind of breaks down and erodes trust. So yeah, if you had been, you know, the one person in the Navy who didn't swear, then yeah, very much so, you would have been far less accepted by your comrades.
Yeah. Well, I suppose there's two sides to that. So if you join in, then because you use the expression in the book, the team that swears together stays together. So that it can be very bonding experience. But I do have a friend who feels he's suffered quite badly through. He's found it with office banter to be quite excluding for him because he sees himself as an introvert, and he sees that swearing and banter comes a lot more easily to people more on the extroverted spectrum of I don't know what your thoughts would be on that.
I haven't actually read or seen any research on that, and it's one that I'd really like to look into. There is, you know, perhaps for the second edition of the book, there might be some studies on that by then. If not, I might have to design some of my own. We don't know a lot about different personality traits and swearing.
Right.
We do know people who are, so there's something called trait aggression, so how likely you are to express your anger, and that people who are less likely to express their anger in day-to-day life still find relief from swearing or from video games when it comes to cutting pain or to withstanding pain. So it may well be that even if your mate isn't a fan of using swearing in the workplace, it would still work to help with pain. But we don't know much about introversion and extroversion. We don't know much about sort of the big five personality characteristics, like, you know, how open you are, how agreeable and so forth. I would love to see some research and find out whether, because I'd mainly looked at whether or not the slurs are exclusionary. And again, it depends on the level of your trust relationship with someone. And quite often when it's a reclaimed slur within a group, it is a sign of like high group bonding. But I hadn't looked at whether or not swearing as a whole could be, or banter as a whole could be exclusionary, just because some people are much less comfortable with that kind of verbal jousting.
Okay, so let's move on to another benefit that you suggest, that the idea that swearing is correlated with honesty and trust.
Yeah, or certainly that perception of honesty and trust. There are some really interesting studies, particularly about our perception of whether or not someone is being honest and when they use swearing. One of the most interesting ones comes from a law school in the Netherlands that looked at witness testimony with or without swearing. And look to see whether or not people were more likely or less likely to believe the swearers. And again, the effects run possibly slightly counter to what you'd expect, that someone who swears, particularly someone who is a victim of crime, who swears about the crime and the criminal, is more likely to be believed than someone who doesn't. And we almost have this kind of belief that if someone isn't emotionally invested in what they're saying, that perhaps they're not being truthful about it. And again, this seems like a bit of a faulty bit of programming in the human psyche, because unfortunately, emotion isn't impossible to fake. And again, we see this, you know, obviously actors do it brilliantly for a living, but politicians are extremely good at it as well. And showing a certain amount of emotion through using a rightly chosen bit of swearing is a really powerful way of getting people on side. Yeah. There's another study from the United States that shows that if you make campaign slogans for on-campus politics contain just a little bit of swearing, particularly not so much slogans, but stump speeches, large rhetorical structures, people will remember your point better and also believe that your point makes more sense if you've done a bit of swearing in it, even if the point is pretty much the same. So the way they studied that was to have two opposing viewpoints, and in one place one was presented with swearing and the other without, and then in a different setting they did it the other way around, and they found that just the one with swearing carried the day much more often. So we see it as a marker of honesty, but it's an easily faked one. I think, and if someone isn't swearing spontaneously, I mean, the people who were taking part in these studies, you know, acting as the people doing the swearing in these studies are obviously faking these emotions or this conviction, and yet it still manages to convince people. So again, it's possibly something that we should be aware of. If someone appears to be swearing passionately, you know, are they genuinely passionate? Does it make sense that they really do care about what they're saying, or are we perhaps being slightly manipulated?
Yeah, sure. Well, next question. How crucial was it to our development as a species, do you think?
Well, we can't rerun evolution much as I'd like to, so I know I'm going out on a limb here, but I genuinely think it was probably one of the first parts of language that we had, and one of the parts of language that really helped us work together as a society. And the reason that I'm prepared to go that far out on a limb is because of some research done with an entire family of chimpanzees, a sort of an extended adopted family that lived among humans for well over 30 years in the end. And in these studies, the chimpanzees were taught to sign in the same way that we teach children language, through this kind of really rich interaction. So it's very different to Project NIM, which most people are familiar with when you talk about chimpanzee signing. So this one, Project Washoe, was a kind of study that they call cross-fostering. And if you're going to foster a chimpanzee, one of the first things you want to do is potty train it, because in the wild, chimpanzees will use their excrement as a rather smelly message. They use it territorially. They use it to express their frustration or anger. So teaching them the toilet taboo, making sure that they only ever defecate in an appropriate place, is a really important step if you're going to live alongside them and invite them into your home, which these researchers did.
Yeah.
And the thing is that once you have taught them the toilet taboo, it genuinely does become a taboo to them. They start lying about it, for example, if they do end up having a little accident, or in some cases doing it on purpose in the middle of the hallway rug, and you say, did you do this? They'll sign back, no, it was, you know, Sue or somebody on the team. There's this brilliant bit of dialogue from Roger Foots, the guy who was the founder of this study, or at least one of the really early pioneers of this study. And he has these examples of dialogue where one of the chimpanzees, Lucy, would blame everyone, including Roger himself, before she'd finally admit that it was her that had done it. And Washo, the chimpanzee for whom the whole project is named, she got to the point where she wouldn't go to the toilet out in the woods, that she would demand, you know, some kind of receptacle to poo in so that it could be disposed of properly.
Yeah.
So that's how we know that defecation is a taboo. And then a really interesting thing happens. They start to use their sign for everything to do with the potty, which is a sign that they render as dirty, but is bringing the back of the wrist up under the jaw. And they use that whenever they're angry or frustrated. So Washo, for example, would say dirty Roger when he wouldn't let her go out and play and wanted to carry on doing experiments, or dirty monkey when another primate scared her when she was in one of the animal reserves that they went to. So we know that they then use this in very much the same way that we use swearing. Mm. So that, I think, is fascinating. As soon as you're equipped with both a taboo and the means to express it, it becomes a way of expressing that strong emotion, even to chimpanzees. And when they do that, then the biting and the gouging and the poo flinging and whatever all diminishes, because you have another way of expressing it that isn't harmful to the person you're expressing it to, or at least not physically damaging anyway. So what I suspect, although I have no way of proving, is that if you imagine two early sort of proto-human tribes that have language, have some form of taboo, be it excretory or religious, and they're trying to catch, I don't know, wildebeest or something, and in one tribe, you know, Tharg does something stupid and they lose their prey and they're going to be hungry tonight, and the only way that they can express their deep frustration is to hit Tharg across the face or smack him in the head or whatever, tomorrow Tharg is going to be in no fit state to help them hunt. So he may have learned his lesson, he may be contrite, but at the very best he's going to be, you know, sort of slightly subpar on the hunting front. Whereas if you've got this other tribe in Tharg can be shouted at and told in no uncertain terms that, you know, either he's a piece of, you know, excrement, or may the thunder gods damn you, or what have you, some way powerfully saying to him, buck your ideas up, mate. And he feels that shame and that intense social pain, but isn't physically wounded. He can go out and hunt the next day. And he's feeling this extra motivation to not let the team down, because being sworn at is not a pleasant experience in this particular case.
Yeah.
But he isn't physically damaged. Now, over time, repeating that small advantage of being chastened but still able to hunt has got to be a bit of an advantage. And I'm aware that, you know, that is kind of a lot of conjecture to stack one upon the other, but it's certainly not inconsistent with anything we know about swearing.
Yeah, sure. I thought it was great in the book when you said, let us allow men to cry and women to swear. We need both means of expression. So in what ways do women swear differently perhaps to men, or on what frequency is it different? And how has that perhaps changed over time?
Yeah, I mean, back earlier than, beginning of sort of Shakespeare's time, you still see lots of historical records that talk about women swearing with the same admiration that they talk about men swearing. You know, if someone was known to be a particularly inventive user of invective or sort of slightly lewd rhetoric, then she was written up as like, cool, she's a champ. And there was an historian I met when we did a Radio 3 program, and he read out this woman inveighing against another woman, and I can't remember the exact details, but it's something like, not two, not three, not five, not 20 knaves is enough to satisfy the lust of you wanton whore, or something. And like, back in the day, it's like, yay, whoa, go for it, you know, Pamela or Sarah or whatever. And then this guy comes along called Richard Alastry, who was chaplain to, I think, Charles II. I'm more on the science than the history, I must admit, at this point. And he writes this book called The Lady's Calling, which is the least patronising part of it, is the title. And he basically says that women who swear are an affront to God. And also, if women swear, they're going to basically turn into men. And so they should really just stop it, unless they want to become these sort of unnatural and grotesque creatures. And this idea really catches on. And from that point onwards, language gets ever more divided into powerful language for men and purity for women. But the thing is that when you think of the reality of women's lives, and particularly the reality of childbirth and child rearing, there's an awful lot of bodily functions that women were exposed to and still had words to express, but they stopped using them in front of men. So we had this belief for a very long time that women swore less than men, because when men asked them, they would say, oh, what? No, me? Gosh, no, wouldn't swear. Definitely wouldn't swear. No, terrible thing. But then you get women working in psychology research around the middle of the last century going, well, that doesn't sound right to me. I swear, and a lot of my friends swear. And it turns out that as soon as you have a woman asking, the women will freely admit quite what a wonderful and wide array of swear words they do use. It tends to be that women use slightly milder forms of swearing than men, but we definitely use it both as frequently and also for the same range of reasons, from elation to frustration, as men do, which still hasn't stopped male researchers writing papers with questions like, why do women swear? No one's ever thought to ask the question why men swear, but it turns out, yeah, we swear for exactly the same reasons you do.
Another question about gender is that I spent many years as a foreign language teacher, and one of the things I noticed that often when you looked at linguistic pairs, the female equivalent, you know, in a pair, would often have a slightly more or a strongly more negative connotation, like, for example, master and mistress, dog and bitch, king and queen, etc. And like, I'm just thinking of my partner. She feels like, with some words, like the strongest word in the English language, cunt. Why should that be such a negative word when it's just referring to female genitalia? So, well, she's on a little crusade. So whenever she gets the urge to say the dog's bollocks, she actually says it's the bitch's cunt, because she wants to actually reclaim it for women, you see, and say, you know, well, both words, because it say that, yeah. Why don't we make these words positive? Is that something you've noticed too?
It's something I've noticed. I haven't seen any research on it, but it's something I definitely noticed during the process of researching the book. And it really helps sort of crystallize my feelings. And like your partner, I would love to reclaim the word cunt, because I grew up in the 90s mainly. And at that point, cunt and twat were largely interchangeable. Yeah. Cunt was always a bit more severe, but you were equally as likely to apply it to a man, and it meant someone who's been a bit of an idiot. So it was derogatory, but it wasn't a gendered slur. But I think a lot of this is to do with our increasing exposure to the American usage of it, which is almost exclusively as a gendered slur, that increasingly younger women are on the receiving end of it. You know, if they speak up on social media or they make YouTube videos or in any way in the public eye. And as soon as you express an opinion, and I can feel myself at the moment sort of trying not to slip into self-censorship for fear of being called that word on social media. Yeah. But as soon as you dare express an opinion that's contrary to certain male egos or certain world views, that you just can't read your Twitter mentions or navigate your Facebook page without swimming in a sea of cunts, if you pardon the sort of old image. So, I mean, what people mean, what those people mean when they say it, is the same thing that Donald Trump said when he used the phrase nasty woman about Hillary Clinton in the debates, I think. Yeah. They use it to mean someone who isn't basically acquiescing to what I see as my rightful place as being powerful. When Harvey Weinstein called Rose McGowan, Anne Hathaway, you know, there's a couple of allegations about Harvey Weinstein saying that when women said no to him, that he would instantly start calling them a cunt. And what he meant was, you're not the kind of woman who'll do what I tell you to.
Yeah.
So if that's what cunt means, someone who won't do what the likes of Harvey Weinstein or Donald Trump tell them, then yeah, sure, I aspire to be a cunt.
Brilliant, Emma. There's a nice little segue into my next question, basically about foreign languages, because I mentioned earlier I spent quite a few years in Spain. And what's fascinating about the word cunt in Spanish, it just doesn't have anything like the same strength. You might see two really well-dressed elderly ladies walking down the street and haven't seen each other for ages, and they've gone, coño! It's like, but it doesn't mean, it's sort of, it's probably more like bless my fanny or something. It has that sort of connotation. It's just like how marvellous it is to see you, but it just doesn't have the same strength. It's lovely.
I would love to believe that, say, 10, 15 years down the line, I don't know how old your partner is, but yeah, maybe 20 years down the line, that we might sort of see each other in the street and go, Gonya, cunt, hey, oh, cunt, how are you doing? I would love for it to be that affectionate. Yeah. But yeah, the problem is that we don't get to individually decide what words mean. We decide as a society. So it's overcoming that deep-seated misogyny that means that, yeah, the female side of the pairing is usually devalued, and somehow addressing that underlying sort of societal consensus that somehow, yeah, the female part of the equation is less worthwhile.
Yeah. The middle way, Emma, as we understand it in the middle way society, is the idea that we perhaps make better judgments by avoiding fixed or dogmatic beliefs about things, and that whether these beliefs are positive or negative. That then throws us back onto experience, so we're left in this messy, uncertain middle. But from our perspective, arguably in the messy, uncertain middle, that we can actually start to get to grips more adequately with the phenomena that we encounter. Now, how might that relate to what we've been talking about today?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly something that, you know, makes me think about the title of the book, The Swearing Is Good For You, is obviously a sort of somewhat polemical title, yeah. Meant to make you grab it off the bookshelves, hopefully. But the thing is, it's good for you in the way that, say, for example, you know, paracetamol is good for you if you've got a headache, or fibre is good for you. The poison is always in the dose. So one of the things that really changed in me as I was researching the book was this realisation that if we don't preserve some of the power of the taboos that we have now, the ones that are particularly about copulation and excretion, the next most strong language that we have is all to do with slurs and the kinds of things that divide us rather than bringing us together.
Yeah.
So I went from being a sort of you know, just there's no problem with using swearing as long as you're using it judicious, you know, as long as you're using it in a way that's socially appropriate. But I've actually sort of slightly pulled back some of my own use of swearing, because I know that I want to keep those particular swear words you know, fresh and punchy.
Yeah.
So that was part of it, that sort of that changing nuance in my position. And one of the things that I hope the book will do is help people sort of recognize the emotional response that they have to swearing and the kind of cultural freight that, you know, we we internalize as children, whether it's that your parents have said things like, oh, well, wash your mouth out with soap and water, or, oh, only ill-educated people swear, or, you know, don't speak like that. It's unbecoming of a young lady. You know, that we can actually start to question why we have these received beliefs and look a bit more. Yeah, as you say, the incredibly messy and sometimes slightly contradictory, but then incredibly intriguing picture of where the evidence shows us, because there's nothing like curiosity and openness and wondering why something is the way that it is to lead you towards, you know, more insight, more learning and deeper understanding. It's when you believe that you've properly understood something, because everything that you have in front of you is kind of nicely consistent, neatly boxed up, that kind of learning stagnates. So I'm all for more curiosity and more unpacking of these ideas.
Brilliant. Okay. And my last question, if people wanted to find out more about your work, how would they go about it?
Sure. So I have a website, which is emmaburn.net. And I usually keep that up to date, depending on how incredibly busy I am at the time, with a few blog posts and things like that. And also mentions if I will be appearing at a literary festival or a bookshop or a science cafe near you. I also have a Twitter feed, which is SciWryBy, which is SciWryBy. But I'm as likely to be retweeting, you know, videos of robots as, you know, something about how a certain American president has annoyed me today. So it's not always about the science of swearing on there. And yeah, that's the two main ways that I tend to pop up in people's lives at the moment.
Okay, fantastic. And well, just in closing, I'd just like to say for any listeners out there, what a thoroughly enjoyable read your book was, and I learned a lot from it too. It was very insightful, and I generally feel quite positive about swearing anyway, but it really opened my eyes about a few things. So thank you very much for giving up your time to talk to me today.
Great talking to you too, and I shall start saying the bitch is cunt, because that's awesome. Oh, kudos to your partner.
Oh, she'll that will make her day. She's on a mission.
You can find out more about Middleway philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.